Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly podcast about role-playing games. Hello and welcome to On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly podcast about role-playing games and the gamers who game them. My name is Eran Aviram.
My name is Uri Lifshitz. Hello!
And today we'll be discussing organizations, not your own style of organization around the table or how you take care of your campaign notes or your character sheet or all of that, but in-play organizations, organizations within the world, and why they are, I think, one of the most useful fictional entities we can have in the game, either as GMs or as player characters. The main thing, I think, is that organizations have reputation, history, motivation, their own style, just like a person. But all of these can be easily passed to each of the members of that organization. So you can always have a person, like, for example, just walk into the room and say they have the logo of Schmil Schmil on their hat, and the players know so much about this person just from you saying these two words. Well, maybe not Schmil Schmil, but you know, the name of the organization you're using.
Indeed, and one would ask, what's an organization? Because when me and you say organization in this context, I don't think we mean what a lot of other people are thinking. A lot of people are thinking organizations are either mega corporation or orders of knighthood, etc., etc., and they are. But I think it's much more than that. What I mean when I say organization, I mean any kind of support system. If you would think about it, anyone who seeks to go on a great endeavor of some sort in your role-playing game or in real life need some sort of a support system which enable them to do whatever it is they do. Now, that support system have some sort of a structure. For example, consider the leader of a magician guild. He has the whole resources of the guild behind him. And that's how he managed to make a big difference in the world. But don't limit yourself to the obvious. A politician can simply have a political party behind him, and that's fine. But he could also have a mafia boss behind him that he gets bribed from or help him with his whatever. Or he can have a whole cult behind him which support him and help him to do whatever it is he does. He can have a secret drug cartel that he manages. Each one of these would be a support structure that lend power and abilities to that politician. And each one of those, as you can imagine, is a very, very different organization with a different structure, a different history. And what I think is one of the most important things, a different code of conduct, which kind of manifests how that organization is doing things.
So what's a code of conduct for you? What do you mean by that?
How that organization is doing business, what threatens that organization, and how they react to people outside the organization or inside the organization. Basically, the code of conduct is like a style guide how to play someone from this organization.
I'll give a link in the show notes to CGP Grey's Rules for Rulers, which is a great and short video that explains a bit about this whole thing, about why people need other people and in what sort of organizations people assemble themselves naturally in our world. And this, of course, is used in any fictional world as well.
Yeah, that I must give a disclaimer. This is an amazingly depressing short film. So watch it, you know, with whatever comfort food you need.
Let us continue. How do we form an organization?
Well, for me, there's a whole list of questions, a very short list, mind you, question which I find the most interesting in how to create an organization. And number one, and I think this is the most important question in life, as in fictional organization, who decides? The minute there is some sort of disagreement inside this organization, who decides what the organization does? Do we support this outcast or do we turn him down? Do we teach this young Padawan the ways of the Force, or do we say, no, too much anger in him, and move on? Who decide these major decisions? And I think the answer to that already gives you a whole wealth of information regarding that specific organization. How is it run? Who decides means who says what has to be done, and to whom do they say it? Who is in charge of enforcing the will of whoever decides? The simple answer to that question, immediately build an organization. And that's just the first question. I would also urge every one of our listeners to think of an organization that they know, be it in real life or inside their campaign setting, and simply answer that question, who decides? If you want to even challenge yourself further, ask, what's the process in which they decide? And that already gives you an amazing insight into that organization.
I think my first question would probably be, where do I need this organization? And I will probably start with the bottom up and not from the top to the bottom, because I am usually thinking about the henchman in the field, the person that the characters will get to meet right here, right now. And that is usually either a lieutenant or someone from the lower ranks, etc. Just for an example, in a scene, the organization of the role-playing game I'm working on right now, and you can read all about it in up4players.com, that's the main organization that the player characters belong to in Crystal Heart. The people that decide what is happening, no one knows who they are. They are these five legendary figures that are responsible of the Council of Sin, which is the main, but no one knows anything about them. And even the setting book barely reveals anything about them, which, by the way, works well with what you just said, because one of the main things about Sin is how mysterious and powerful it is. And is it a good organization or is it a bad organization? What do they actually want? And keeping the council hidden from the players even helps in establishing this air of mystique around the whole organization.
The second question is, how is that organization structured? Does it have a strict hierarchy? Is it a federated organization? Is it run in sort of a loose anarchy of sort? Does it have cells which work independently of one another? Now, you can already see that each one of those structures lends itself very well to specific type of organization. Hierarchy is a very, very easy way and most organized way to go. Federated organization usually have a reason to be federated. Either they're in different countries, different dimensions, different worlds, etc. An anarchy organization, and I suggest reading about anarchy, it's not just everyone does whatever they want, is a very interesting way. You can have a commune of nature-loving druids who have a complete anarchy. No one actually decides what to do unless they reach some sort of a consensus, and then everyone go about his or her own way of doing what the consensus decided.
I think that the Harpers in Forgotten Realms are an example of this. It's a very loose organization of people that, generally speaking, are trying to do good and stop evil magic users and the like. But they don't really have leaders. They have some people of influence within the organization, but they all just work with, well, a sort of a code of conduct and try to do the best in order to achieve their goals, without actually working with one another. Maybe they do, but it's on occasion. It's not like the main thing. It's like in a hierarchy, for example, where everyone under this and this boss do this and this thing that the boss told them to do.
Yeah, an excellent example, and one that there's so much lore and interest behind, which is really fun to read in. Our next question would be, for me at least, what would generate a response from this organization?
Ooh, interesting.
I think that's a way of asking, what are their interests? What do they really care about? Because what generates a response from an organization is something that organization holds dear. If you're talking about a drug cartel, trying to move in on their turf would generate a response. That means that's what's important to them. I intentionally phrased my question, what generates a response from the organization, rather than what's important to the organization. Because an organization can have a motto, can have established goals and vision and whatever. But at the end of the day, what's really important for an organization is the thing that they will react to. If this organization fights undead, then you know that sending undead into town would generate a response from them. Now, for example, breaking into their temple and stealing some of their money or holy relics, what response would that generate? I think that's the best scale you can have to measuring what this organization really cares about.
Because most of the time I approach organization with the question of, what are they doing in my game? How are they are serving the plot? I will go for the most straightforward, what is their motivation? Because that really helps me with deciding what to do after the players do something. So the players, for example, assault the temple where the organization is holding their, let's say, relics. What is the organization's motivation? Well, they are trying to destroy the dragon that rules the city. Do they care then about this? Yes, because they were going to use the relic for something. I need to think about what specifically or connect it to something else that is happening. Ah, yes, they really needed this relic because there's this rebellion that they're going to do in 3 days and they need this relic in order to do so, etc. So it's similar to what you're doing, but for me, by keeping a motivation, like one line or two lines, they want this and this and this. Maybe by doing this and this and this. By having this motivation in front of me, I always know how the organization, and therefore any person that belongs to it, react to whatever it is that the players are doing.
It is very interesting because you can see the differences with me being a top to bottom DM and you being a bottom to top DM, and the difference of how you approach object and elements in the world.
Yes.
For me, it would be very important to understand what generates a response from them, because I would immediately think, okay, about the history of this organization and what caused them to be and what got the first reaction to spring this being into being. And you, on the other hand, going to say, okay, I need an organization now because I need someone to advance the plot.
Role in my world, and therefore I need to know how they work.
It's really interesting. I would love to hear from our listeners about, are they more bottom up or top to bottom kind of GM? That's a really interesting question, which I think some GM might not even know how to answer, because they either simply run prepared adventures, in which case you don't need to do any world building or create organizations, or maybe they just simply never consider that question. What's their approach to creating the world around the characters? I'm moving on to my fourth question, which I love because I feel that it always gives an organization a special something. And that is, what commands the respect? If I have an organization and people from that organization going to respect the characters if the character is going to do X, what is X? Now, this has nothing to do with the other questions. If there's a drug cartel and if you move in on their turf, they're going to try and kill you, could be that you're going to command their respect by doing that. But this can be a very easy way of making organizations special. This can be as simple as, okay, we don't harm children, or we try never to hurt the innocents. And that's something that coming from a criminal organization is very nice.
It gives them a humanity that would otherwise be missing. Because organizations can be the sort of like mega corporations from Shadowrun, where they are just these huge entities that are names written in neon lights high above you, and their people are these goons in helmets, and they have guns, and they just rush at you and shoot at you, and that's it. But no, if you know what commands their respect, or at least you see that by doing this and this, they now react to you in respectful way, in a way that they see you as a person, you now see them as a person as well. At least you can.
I wouldn't use the word humanity for the organization, because I would be glad to see an organization that treat with respect to whoever is well-dressed, for example. You know, if you got the right kind of suit for whatever it is you're doing, they're going to respect that. They respect fashion. That doesn't make them humane in any way.
I think it does. I think it does. It gives them a human aspect. Maybe not humane, but a human aspect that makes them actual people that care about stuff and not just about the money or the power. They have a way of doing things, and there are things that are important to them.
Yeah, I take that. I think that simply giving every group of baddies or goodies, for that matter, something which is not doesn't fit the mold, you know, prevent it from turning into just this random caricature of whatever organization you're doing. Okay, they're not just Marines. They're the Marines who are really specific about handling maintenance for their crafts. And if you're going to show up in the middle of their base, they're going to arrest you. But if you're going to show up in the middle of their base with a really well-looked after worn old ship, they're going to respect you for doing that.
Yes, it's a conversation starter, at least.
What, you have double engine on that Helix 450? That's nice. Where did you get the parts? Well, I got him on a small moon off Luna 7. That's nice. Guys, when you put him in jail, you know, keep him on one of the good cells. I want to talk with him later on.
Let us continue, because there are so many other things to say about organizations. One of the things that I really like about organizations, like we said before, just push a person, any NPC, into the player's faces and say that he looks as if he's part of this organization, or she said these and these words that you know are related to a specific organization, and then the players have this whole world of connotations, like a cloud surrounding this new person. And that can be just a schmo from the street, but there are also what I would call lieutenants, people that have specific places, maybe managerial places or leadership positions in the organization, and they represent the organization in various ways. They are the faces that the player characters will actually get to meet and interact with. It might be just the boss for the fight, or it can also be a person that you get to interact with on a regular basis, because again, not all organizations are bad organizations and villains, etc.
I would single out a specific lieutenant, which I would name the right-hand man. The right-hand man, or woman, of course, is the man who actually does the mundane, daily, ungrateful work of making sure the organization runs smoothly. He doesn't necessarily, that person doesn't necessarily care about the long-term goals. His aim are simply to keep the organization running, and that person title can vary greatly depending on the nature of the organization and the setting. It can be the, you know, the COO, chief operation officer. It can be the grand vizier, who simply handle the kingdom while the king do whatever he wants. The head counselor, etc., etc. And I like this role because it lets you give an authority figure, which isn't the big baddie. You know, it's someone that the character can reason with, can talk with. It's someone who's down to earth, who's really all about making things happen. Unlike the big baddie, who is usually, you know, more capricious, he sees the world, he's got the vision, etc. And the right-hand man is someone who simply follow orders and make sure things happen. I think it's a very important role to have in any organization?
I think it's really important for another reason. Again, I go from a different angle at it maybe. When the players are getting too near the boss, they are getting closer and closer on the real deal, on what is actually happening, and things are moving too quickly, and I want to pace it, I can then use the fact that this is an organization and not just a single person to put something in the way which is not as big as the big bad, but is quite big, the right-hand man or any other lieutenant. So they are still facing an aspect of the big deal, but not just the big deal itself. Like they found the murder suspect and now they close in on them, but instead of fighting the murderer himself with the big bad, they get to fight the senior cultists that jumped in front of them and say, "Haha, I'm the senior cultist, fight me." And then they kill her and et cetera, et cetera. Continue on to your things.
One of the best solutions system-wise, which I have encountered dealing with organization, comes from Fate, which have a great concept called Places and Faces. When you create your campaign, you create several places of importance. Now, when I say place, it can be an organization, it can be a location, it can be a political party, it can be anything. And you automatically assign a face to it. A face is a specific person who embodies this place. You can have a huge park in the middle of town or of great mythical significance. And then you say, okay, there's this old ranger who lives in the park and he's the keeper of knowledge, blah, blah, blah. And he's the face of that. When you want to interact with this place, with this location, you usually would interact with him. He's the embodiment of that. There's a political party called the Green Party, and their face is this lawyer who's the head of the party and counselor, and he's the guy to talk to. Or, for example, there's the Mage Guild, and their leader is a fragile young woman named Luna Seven, and she's the person to talk to. If you need something from that organization, that's who you're going to turn to.
I like it for several reasons. First of all, because it gives the player specific connotations for the organization. If, like, for example, the Mage Guild is represented by this frail old woman, then they might think that the organization itself, the Mage Guild, is maybe old and frail as well. But it could be that this person is not actually a good representation of the organization. She's just the person that they know. She's just the NPC that they created and will get to interact with now, but in the future, maybe even by the end of this session, they'll get to see a different aspect of this organization. And I like it because it allows you to, again, show how people and organizations interact, but are not the same thing.
I like it mainly because if it kind of represents the way the characters know the world around them.
Yes, through people, yeah.
Yeah, in the sense that if they want to talk with someone from this organization, they say, oh, there's Luna 7, she's from that organization, let's talk to her.
Yes.
And, of course, some people said this kind of take away the mystery. That doesn't true in my recent Fate game, where this anarchistic, pro-Green Party, nature-loving kind of cult, and their leader was simply called the Gardener. You didn't know who he is, but you knew of him.
In City of Mists, which I'm the editor of, there's the iceberg model, which is an excellent, I think, tool for this sort of thing, to create an organization. Specifically in City of Mists, every organization is, well, not every, but most of them are criminal organizations that are built around a single person, the Avatar, who is basically a supernatural god of a sort. And that person is at the bottom of the iceberg, but it's an iceberg. You only see the surface, the surface 10%, and then you have to dig to discover everything that's under the surface. And there are locations and faces, again, like in Fate, that you create, the GM creates, and you can go either from the bottom up or the other way around. Again, the book explains how to and gives you the tools to make this organization into basically a campaign. So you don't create an organization for its own sake. You create it because this is what the players will go through case by case as they discover what is going on and go deeper and deeper into the mystery. And it's really nice. I really recommend you read it. Finally, there's something that we should really say about organizations, and that's that they are, not usually, but always, in some way, mismanaged. Because people are people. And even if you are not a people, even if the organization is a council of dragons, there will be something that is not perfect about them. They will make mistakes. They will have organizational failures within their system. They will have all sorts of things. And these are not only interesting and useful story-wise, I think, but also give a really powerful, at least to me, sense of immersion. Because if I am against a cult that is always dangerous because they always know where I am and they are always well equipped and they are always ready to attack me and they have all of the right spell, etc., this is an enemy I don't know even how to start, how to begin to tackle. I don't know how to attack it. But if I know they are an organization, and if the image that I got in my head because the GM ran the game in such a way that I feel as if it's actually just people working together to do a thing, then people need to eat and sleep, and they need to keep secrets, but they don't always manage to do so. And they have families, and they have other things in their lives, and there are so many things that can go wrong in this organization because it's made of people. And now I know how to maybe approach this and what to do with this.
Just a quick interjection there. Even if it's not made of people.
Yes, yes, sure.
Computers make mistakes. AIs make mistakes. Elves make mistakes. Dwarves make mistakes. All but halflings.
Halflings are perfect, yes.
Yeah.
Completely, yeah. So, just for starters, always, as a GM, think about how the organization didn't think of everything. They might have missed something. They might have, for example, underestimated the PCs. This is very likely if it's a powerful organization and the PCs are not very known to the organization, if they don't yet have any reputation with it. There's also the chance of human error.
Or elf.
Or elf error, good point, Uri. Where, like, for example, they said, tonight we shall all meet in the Grand Bazaar, whatever, but they don't all meet there. One of them forgot. One of them thought they talked about someplace else. And then when the player characters arrive, one of the evil lieutenants is missing. Because maybe he's sick, maybe his mother asked him to help her in something, and he's just late. He'll arrive in 3 rounds instead of right now.
Maybe his kid is teething, so he need to stay home and help. Maybe he just have the family over for the weekend and he can't be bothered. He needs to cook now.
Maybe someone at a higher level, a secretary somewhere, forgot that this is a holiday today. And when they arranged this convention or whatever, they found themselves unable to, for example, provide food or something. So now everyone in the organization is super hungry in this convention because it's a holiday. There are no cooks around. Everyone is out on the beach or something. Another thing that happens with organization is they tend to be quite static, at least tools-wise. That is, they tend to keep using the same tools, the same systems, the same procedures that they used before, because upgrading is hard. The bigger the organization, the harder it is. Because if you want everyone around your land to start using these new techniques and these new, I don't know, hymns that everyone needs to sing in the morning, let's say it's a temple of some sort, you will now need to distribute this across the whole land. Make sure that they keep doing it despite the fact that, remember, human error, the cleric in this and that town is, drunk most of the day and doesn't really care about what hymns is supposed to do, except for the ones in the evening, because that brings everyone around and they give him more money to buy more drinks. So, you know, he will do the evening ones, but not the morning ones, etc. So upgrading is hard. And if the players manage to advance themselves in various ways, the organization will probably will not be able to keep up and match their new abilities, their new techniques, their new powers, etc. Returning to the human factor, there's the whole thing of bosses. Now, there not every organization has bosses. You said before, Uri, there's like, for example, anarchies, but even there will be people that are more assertive or less assertive. There will be people that are more annoying or less annoying. There will be a lot of in-office politics, even if you don't have an office, even if you are in a cult, even if you are an order of knights. You will not do this and that because X person told you to do it, and you really hate X person. Ever since they said this thing about you and your family during the meeting, you really hate them, so you're not going to do whatever it is that they say. Or maybe you'll do it really slowly, you know? Or maybe you'll do it subpar in some way. Because people are people, wherever they are.
And I suggest taking this opportunity to, you know, every time you had a job and you really hated your boss and you said, I really want to, you know, punch him in the face or just take all his requests and shred them or whatever, take one person in your organization, in the game world, and let them do all those things.
Yes.
That
yes.
person would shred every important message they get from that boss because they hate him. Ah, tonight's the full moon. We need to get all the werewolves to the secret ritual of getting the super moon to eat the moon. Yeah, I will deliver those messages.
Finally, there are two things that happen to almost all organizations. First, the schisms. When an organization becomes two organizations. It happens a lot in religions, but it can happen in basically any other kind of human endeavor. Because people tend to disagree, even if not today, maybe tomorrow, maybe the next generation. Whatever. A cult becomes two cults. The cult of the truth and the cult of the truthiness truth. And they might even like each other, but disagree on specific things. But now there are two organizations, and that's important. Because they no longer work well together as they were before under one leadership. They now have different resources. They now have different cultural norms inside their organizations, etc. And the other thing that happens a lot to organizations is that the reason for their existence stops being relevant. Like, for example, we all banded together in order to mine this mine. And now the mine ran out. There's nothing to mine here anymore. But, I mean, this is what we've been doing and our forefathers have been doing, etc. So what? We stop exist as an organization? We'll stop being this group of people that are doing this thing? No. We'll now become criminals. We'll now become brigands. And this might not be a conscious decision, but, you know, week after week, month after month, more and more people in the organization start to go to the other side of the law. And as time goes, eventually, after 20 years, this is now the group of mining brigands, or probably they have a better name. And the organization keeps on going because the main thing that most organizations are trying to do is keep existing, surviving. Because once you have a lot of people working for a goal, they will keep working even if the goal changes. They will just find another goal at all costs. The organization is now a machine that can't be stopped.
And you can see plenty of examples around. The organization was built for a specific purpose. That purpose has been achieved. But now there's an organization and people want to keep getting their paycheck.
Yes, for example.
You find new goals regardless of the original reason why you were founded.
So that's it. There's quite a lot of things that can happen with organizations. And I think we can summarize it right now, Uri. How about that?
I think we should summarize it simply by saying, if you don't have organizations in your setting, I suggest adding them. If you have organization in your setting, which is very likely, but maybe you haven't thought of them as organization, You simply have a king and his knights. Well, that's an organization. Simply codify it a bit and add a bit more to that to make it a more interesting organization. And I would even suggest taking the time and effort, regardless if you're working top to bottom or bottom up, take the time, create a brand new organization, and simply see how it fits in inside your world, inside your plot, simply to have a more interesting and robust and rich in detail setting for your players. Or if your players try to think of an organization which is relevant to your character and develop that in order to make the world more interesting for everyone who plays.
Talking about the players, I see two main aspects here. First, as a player, yes, think about maybe what sort of role you had in an organization or what sort of role organizations had in your life as the background of where you come from, what sort of person you are. A lot of characters are created as basically lone wolves. They have no family, they have no connections, and you really should have some connections, but they don't have to be to your family. They can be to an organization you were part of, for example, etc. Why did you leave? Did you actually leave? Are you still there? Do you have any sort of responsibilities? If you don't, why, etc., etc.? These are interesting questions, potentially. And the second approach is when the player creates an organization, which, by the way, can happen in a lot of games. Reign, for example, is a game all about having organizations in a fantasy world and sending them against each other, etc. And if they create an organization, all of these things that we've talked about can and should happen in their organization. And the GM can find, I think, a lot of potential plot twists and other things to do with the story in all everything that we've just discussed here. I think it's time to take the load off. Uri, how about you begin?
So about a week and a half ago, I went to Draconicon. Draconicon is a convention. I think it's his 7th or 8th year running here in Israel. It was awesome. I was there for just a tiny bit. I went and I taught a workshop about improvisation in role-playing games. I can give you a bunch of numbers. There were 5 LARPs in the convention, 3 workshops, 51 tabletop games in 63 gaming tables, and more and more. Excellent, excellent convention. And I can say for myself, I taught a workshop about improvisation, which is, you know, it's kind of easy for me because I've been improvising professionally for, I think, 8 years now. And I've been role-playing for over 30, so I feel really, really good in both of these fields. And, you know, working with, I think, about 15 people about what their problem is, where do they get stuck in the middle of a session as players or as GMs, and what's difficult for them, how to suddenly react to things that are happening in the game which caught them by surprise, or if they need to invent a name or a location or simply to describe something in a new way, and after years of gaming and they can't come up with something. And just having that ability to give people tools to get over those things which hinder their fun is something that really fills my engines. It's so much fun.
I didn't go to a convention, but instead I wrote an article. Now, Uri, maybe you remember, like 2 months ago, we did an episode about bringing new people into the hobby. And we talked a lot, and you had an article ready, and I said, yes, I have an article ready as well. It will be up by the end of the week. It wasn't. It's up now! Woohoo! So I'll give a link in the show notes. It's pretty long. I won't lie to you, Uri. It's pretty, pretty long. And actually, it's part one, because there's also part two in which you give a short scenario of how to introduce D&D, the scenario that I used to do when I introduced D&D. And that will be coming up in next week. No, I don't know. I won't promise things that I can't keep. It will be coming up sometime in the future.
And I know all of you are now rushing to the website of this podcast, but it's not actually there. It's in eranaviram.me, Eran's personal site, where there's a lot of good stuff. Not a lot of articles because they're amazingly long.
Yes.
But head over there and read. We will give a link in the show notes, of course.
Now, guys, if you liked what you heard here, excellent. How about you go to dwarfcast.net and try some other things? Also, how about you go to wherever it is from which you've downloaded this episode and give us some number of stars or likes, because it really helps us. Well, the more stars and likes, the better, of course. You can also send us an email at show@dwarfcast.net in which you explain why you gave us a specific number of stars and or likes, or just give us some other thing to talk about. Like, for example, a question about something that happened to you in the game and you are unsure about. And you maybe want a different perspective about it. And we will do an episode about it. Or not. We can just answer your email without doing an episode about it. Just make sure that you actually ask for it in the email. You can also just wait another week and meet us here. Because that's how it works. Every Monday, you will hear another episode in this RSS feed.
Bam, bam, bam! And now we shall say goodbye, each in our own native tongue.
Leitraot! On the Shoulder of Dwarves is shared under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial 4. The intro and outro are taken from Silly Fun by Kevin MacLeod. Licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3. Find us at dwarfcast.net and follow us on Twitter or Facebook.